Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've got quite the collection of material in front of us today, all focused on one city.
That's right. We're diving deep into Vienna, or Wien, as you'd say, if you were there.
Exactly. And it's a city that's almost impossible to pin down, isn't it? You have this incredible imperial grandeur, this history.
6.5 centuries of Habsburg rule shaping everything. It's mind-boggling.
But then it's also, super modern. It tops those livability rankings year after year. It's green, it's vibrant.
And quirky. Let's not forget the quirky side. It has these curious stories, these unexpected corners.
Right. So, yeah, defining it is tough. Is it the Kaiserstadt, the city of emperors?
Or the music metropole, the birthplace of psychoanalysis, a hub for radical art.
It's all of those things. So, our mission today with all this source material is to cut through the usual tourist stuff.
Yeah, we want to get to the core insights, understand that unique mix, the history, the culture, and that modern pulse. How does it all fit together?
Okay, let's ground ourselves first. Some basic facts. Vienna. It's big.
Pretty substantial, yeah. 415 square
And
kilometers.
population.
Just shy of 1.9 million people live there now.
Which makes it Austria's biggest city, obviously.
But also, importantly, the ninth largest city in the whole European Union, so it still carries significant weight.
Yeah, it's not just a historical relic, it's a major European capital today.
But the sources, and I think this is key, they keep coming back to the idea that its size isn't the defining
No,
thing.
it's the Mischung, that blend.
Exactly. That mixture of centuries of history, really profound history, and this Lebenslust.
Lust for life. You feel it, apparently, in the coffee houses, the wine taverns.
It's baked into the culture. But to really understand that present-day Lebenslust, you absolutely have to start with the past. The weight of that history is immense.
Okay, so let's dig into that past. Where does Vienna even begin?
Well, the earliest settlers were Celts, but the Vienna we sort of recognize starts, like so many European cities, with the Romans.
Right, Vindobona, the Roman military camp.
Exactly. Established in the 1st century AD, and it wasn't just some random outpost.
No, the location was strategic, wasn't it, on the Danube?
Critically important. It was right on the limes, the northern frontier of the Roman Empire. The Danube was the highway and the barrier.
So military first, but then trade follows.
Pretty quickly, yeah. Its position meant it naturally grew into a really important trading center during the Middle Ages. Location, 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 even back then.
Okay, so Roman roots, medieval trading hub, but the identity, the Vienna we picture with the palaces and the grandeur, that comes later.
That comes with the Habsburgs. They arrive on the scene around the 13th century, maybe the 1270s.
And they stick around for a while.
Just a bit, almost 650 years, continuously.
Wow, okay, stop there. 650 years of continuous rule by one dynasty in one capital.
Think about what that means. Most other big European capitals, London, Paris, they had revolutions, changes in regime, breaks in that continuity.
So Vienna had this unbroken line of imperial power shaping it.
Precisely. For 6.5 centuries, it was the undisputed political heart of a massive Central European empire. And that sheer concentration of power over that length of time, that's the so what?
Right, that's why the monumental architecture feels so cohesive,
Yeah.
so dominant.
Exactly. It wasn't piecemeal. It was centuries of deliberate imperial construction, projecting power and
Who are
permanence.
the key emperors driving that? I mean, you can't cover, say, 150 years, but who stands out?
Well, you've got to mention Maria Theresia in the 18th century, a huge figure. She really consolidated the empire, reformed the administration, and oversaw a kind of golden age. Her influence is everywhere, especially Schönbrunn Palace.
Okay, and then later.
Later, you have Franz Joseph I. His reign stretches from the mid-19th century right up to World War I.
Which didn't end well for the empire.
No, it ended catastrophically. But before the collapse, his long reign saw that final massive transformation of Vienna's look, especially the building of the Ringstrasse, that huge boulevard.
So essentially, the imperial coffers paid for Vienna's architectural identity for nearly 7 centuries.
Pretty much. That's how you get the Hofburg complex, Schönbrunn, the Ringstrasse buildings. It wasn't just about looking nice. It was a physical manifestation of power, of stability, of imperial destiny.
Built to impress, built to last.
Built to say, this is the center of the world and it's not going anywhere. Compared to other capitals whose histories are more fractured, Vienna has this incredibly unified imperial stamp.
Okay, but here's the twist, right? The sources really emphasize this paradox, this incredibly rigid, conservative, imperial city.
Somehow becomes this hotbed for revolutionary ideas, ideas that completely changed art, music, science.
How does that even happen? You've got this iron fist of the Habsburgs, this strict hierarchy, and yet.
Well, that's the million-dollar question about Vienna. One theory is that the very intensity of that imperial atmosphere, maybe even its repressiveness, created a kind of pressure cooker.
Like the pushback had to be equally intense.
Something like that. The tension between the surface order and the inner turmoil seems to have fueled incredible intellectual and artistic breakthroughs. It wasn't just cultural decoration, it was fundamental shifts in thinking.
Let's talk specifics. Music, obviously. Vienna is music.
It's inseparable. You have the giants of the first Viennese school working here, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, later Schubert. They weren't just employees of the court.
No, they were fundamentally changing music itself, weren't they? Taking classical forms and infusing them with, like, personal emotion, drama.
Absolutely. They basically invented the symphony, the string quartet as we know them. Their work here echoed across Europe and still defines classical music today. The music often felt bigger, more universal than the imperial setting it came from.
And then, completely different field, you get Sigmund Freud in Vienna.
Right here, developing psychoanalysis, literally inventing a new way for humans to understand their own minds. The unconscious, desires, dreams.
In a city obsessed with surface propriety and order.
Exactly. His ideas about hidden drives and suppressed instincts were flying directly in the face of Vienna's buttoned-up society. You can almost feel the tension that must have generated his theories.
And visually, you have the art world exploding, too. Gustav Klimt and the secession movement.
Yeah, Klimt rejecting the stuffy academic art the establishment loved. He brings in symbolism, ornamentation, this shocking sensuality.
It's ambitious at the time, right.
Hugely. But also defining modern art. Again, it's pushing against the grain right there in the imperial capital.
So it's music, psychology, art, all breaking molds, all happening around the same time in the same city.
It's this incredible convergence, a city built on centuries of tradition, power, and control, simultaneously acting as the launching pad for ideas that would undermine all of that, often nurtured, ironically, in the coffee houses we'll get to later, that duality. That's Vienna.
Okay, so to really grasp that historical weight and that grandeur, you need to see the landmarks. Where do we start? It has to be the center, right?
Absolutely. Stephansdom. St. Stephen's Cathedral, or Steffel, as the Viennese affectionately call it.
It's right in the middle of everything, isn't it? You can't miss it.
It literally rises from the geographical center of the inner city. It's the spiritual heart, a masterpiece of Gothic architecture.
And that South Tower, it's huge.
137 meters tall. It's visible from almost anywhere as you approach the city center. A true beacon.
But the thing everyone talks about, the thing you see in photos, is that roof.
Oh, the roof is spectacular. It's not just functional. It's a work of art in itself.
How many tiles are we talking?
The sources say over 230,000 glazed colored tiles.
Wow.
And they're arranged in these intricate diamond patterns, plus the Habsburg double-headed eagle and the coats of arms of Vienna and Austria. It's dazzling.
And inside, it's not just Gothic, is it?
No, it's layered. You've got stunning Gothic sculptures and artworks, but then also these incredibly elaborate Baroque altars added later. It shows the evolution of style over centuries.
Yeah, and then there are the catacombs underneath.
Right. Which adds another layer, that sense of deep history, holding remains of Habsburgs, bishops, and thousands of ordinary Viennese from plague times. It's been the city's living, breathing center for centuries.
Okay, from the spiritual heart to the imperial summer home, Schönbrunn Palace.
Schloss Schönbrunn, yeah, the former summer residence. And it's so much more than just a house. It's a whole complex UNESCO World Heritage Site, which tells you something.
The scale is just immense. The sources mention over 1,400 rooms.
That's the number, yeah. Imagine the staff needed. This was where Maria Theresia held court in the summer, where Emperor Franz Joseph and Empress Sisi spent time.
So those grand staterooms, they were designed to impress visiting dignitaries. All that Rococo gold and...
Absolutely. It was political theater. You needed that splendor to project the power and wealth of the empire. It had to accommodate not just the family, but thousands of courtiers, officials, servants, a whole traveling city almost.
But Schönbrunn isn't just the building, is it? The grounds are a huge part of it.
Oh, definitely. The palace part is vast and magnificent in its own right. Formal gardens, fountains, sculptures, fake Roman ruins.
And the zoo. You mentioned the zoo earlier.
Tiergarten Schönbrunn. Critically, it's the oldest continuously operating zoo in the entire world, founded back in 1752 by Maria Theresia's husband.
So you have this combination, imperial history, formal gardens, and world's oldest zoo, all in one place.
It shows the breadth of imperial interests, from statecraft to botany to zoology. It's a unique combination for visitors today. You get history and recreation.
Okay, so if Schönbrunn was the summer escape, the Hofburg was the day job, the real seat of power.
For centuries, yes, located right in the heart of the old town. This was the engine room of the Habsburg Empire.
And it's not really one single palace, is it? It looks more like a sprawling complex of connected buildings.
That's exactly what it is. It grew over time, wing after wing added across centuries, reflecting the empire's expansion. A city within a city, really.
And even though the empire's gone, the Hofburg is still central to Vienna today.
Very much so. It houses some incredibly important Austrian institutions. You've got the Austrian National Library in there.
The Prunksaal, the state hall, is supposed to be breathtaking.
It is. Just incredible Baroque library design. Then there's the Spanish Writing School.
With the Lapidziner Stallions. Mm-hmm. A huge tourist draw, but also a serious piece of cultural heritage.
Absolutely. A living tradition. Plus, there are multiple museums within the Hofburg complex, covering everything from imperial apartments to silver collections.
And the imperial treasury, right, where they keep the crown jewels.
Exactly. The Schatzkammer. Holding the symbols of that power, the imperial crown of Austria, the Holy Roman Empire regalia, so it remains this potent symbol right in the city center.
Okay, one more huge imperial statement piece. The Ringstrasse. The Ring Road.
Ah, yes. The Ring. Probably one of the most magnificent boulevards anywhere in the world, and it wasn't accidental. It was deliberate, large-scale urban planning.
Built in the 19th century, under Franz Joseph, what was there before?
The old city walls and fortifications. By the mid-19th century, they were militarily obsolete and, frankly, constraining the city's growth.
So tearing them down was a big deal.
A huge symbolic and practical move. It opened up the city, physically and metaphorically. It was a statement of modernity, security, and embracing the rising middle class, the bourgeoisie.
Ah, so it wasn't just about making things look grand. It was a socio-political statement, creating space for this new influential class.
Precisely. It provided a showcase for their wealth and cultural aspirations, with land available for them to build grand apartment blocks and public buildings, balancing the old aristocratic power of the Hofburg. The Ringstrasse is like an architectural museum of that era, the Gründer site.
So if you walk or take a tram around the Ring, what do you see? It's like a checklist of Viennese institutions.
It really is. You start maybe with the magnificent state opera house.
Then the Hofburg complex has a section facing the Ring.
Right, the Nuremberg Wing. Then you keep going, you see the grand museums.
The twin museums, art history and natural history.
Exactly, the Kunsthistorisches Museum and the Naturhistorisches Museum, facing each other across Maria Theresienplatz, a huge statement about the empire's commitment to both arts and sciences.
And then?
Then you hit the Parliament Building, designed deliberately in a Greek classical style.
A nod to democracy, even within an empire.
You could read it that way, certainly. Then the incredibly ornate neo-Gothic Rathaus, the City Hall.
It's more like a cathedral.
It's immense. And then the main building of the University of Vienna, another massive statement. Mm-hmm. And the Votivkirche, it just goes on.
Wow. So a stroll along the Ringstrasse is basically a crash course in 19th century imperial Vienna's self-image.
Absolutely. Power, culture, knowledge, civic pride. It's all there, laid out in stone, perfectly curated.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the monumental buildings, the imperial legacy, but Vienna's soul, that's something different, isn't it? It lives in the culture. And as we said, that culture often had a life of its own, sometimes even pushing against the empire.
And you have to start with music. It just feels fundamental to Vienna.
It's completely woven into the city's fabric, more than almost any other city, maybe. The sheer amount of canonical classical music composed or premiered here is staggering.
We mentioned the first Viennese school already. Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, setting the foundations.
Then you have later figures like Brahms, Bruckner, Mahler, wrestling with those legacies, and of course, the Strauss dynasty.
Johann Strauss II of Sisson, the Waltz Kings.
Making Vienna synonymous with the waltz, with light opera, with that sense of charm and joie de vivre, their music defined an era and an image of the city.
And crucially, this isn't just history gathering dust in archives. The sources make it clear Vienna lives this musical legacy today.
Oh, absolutely. You have world-class institutions like the Wiener Philharmoniker, the Vienna Philharmonic, consistently ranked among the very best orchestras globally.
And the Vienna State Opera, the Staatsoper. One of the world's leading opera houses.
These aren't museums. They are living, breathing centers of musical excellence, performing this repertoire constantly. Think about the New Year's concert.
Broadcast everywhere. It's like Vienna officially kicks off the new year for half the planet with waltzes.
Exactly. It keeps that musical heritage front and center in the city's identity.
Okay, from music to another uniquely Viennese institution, the coffee house.
Ah, the coffee house. And this is important. It's not just a cafe. It's much more than that.
So much more that it's recognized by UNESCO, right, as intangible cultural heritage.
That UNESCO designation is key. It tells you this is about social and cultural practice, not just about coffee beans.
The sources describe it as a kind of public living room.
That's a great way to put it. A place where you can go order one coffee, maybe a melange.
That's the classic Viennese one. Sort of like a cappuccino, but different.
Yeah. Steamed milk, foam, often served in a glass with a small glass of water on the side. And you can sit there for hours.
Read the newspapers provided, write, talk, just think without being hassled to order more or leave.
Exactly. That's the tradition. It fostered this unique atmosphere. Historically, these places were crucibles.
Incubators, you called them earlier. For writers, thinkers.
Absolutely. Writers like Peter Altenberg basically lived in the Café Central. Musicians like Gustav Mahler held court. Thinkers, revolutionaries. Freud apparently frequented Café Lantmann. They met, they argued, they debated, they scribbled ideas on napkins.
So under the nose of the imperial censors, this is where a lot of that radical thought actually happened.
It provided a space for it. A relatively affordable, accessible, neutral ground where ideas could be exchanged, sometimes dangerously revolutionary ideas. It was the unofficial intellectual hub.
So UNESCO recognizes that historical role, that social function. That's fascinating.
And the ritual is important, too. You get your melange, maybe, and you have to have cake.
Sacre-tort. Has to be Sacre-tort, right? The famous chocolate cake.
It's the iconic choice, that rich, dense chocolate cake with the apricot jam layer. Though there are many other amazing pastries, of course.
Didn't the sources mention some kind of fight over the original Sacre-tort recipe?
Oh, yes. The legendary legal battles between the Hotel Sacher and Demel Pastry Shop over who had the original Sacre-tort recipe.
Yeah.
It went on for years. Very Viennese taking cake very seriously.
Okay, cake is crucial. But what about actual meals, the big Viennese classics?
Right, the savory side. You absolutely have to mention Wiener Schnitzel.
The real deal, made with veal, pounded super thin, breaded, fried golden, and huge, right? Often bigger than the plate.
That's the one, a true classic. And then there's Tafelspitz.
Boiled beef. Doesn't sound that exciting.
Ah, but it is. It was Emperor Franz Joseph's favorite dish. It's prime beef, gently simmered in broth with root vegetables, served with roasted potatoes, creamed spinach, and crucially, apple horseradish sauce and chive sauce.
Okay, that sounds much better. More complex.
It's actually incredibly flavorful and refined when done well. It represents that traditional, hearty, but carefully prepared Austrian cuisine.
And beyond the big showstoppers, smaller things.
Loads. You've got Kipferl, the crescent-shaped pastry's ancestor of the croissant, Palitschinken, which are like thin Austrian crepes, served sweet or savory, and apple strudel.
But the Viennese version is special, isn't it? With that super thin stretched dough.
Exactly. Paper thin dough, stretched by hand, layered with apples, raisins, cinnamon. It's lighter and flakier than other versions. Delicious.
Okay, my mouth is watering. One more culinary thing, the Heerige. What exactly are those?
Ah, the Horiger experience. This is really unique to Vienna and its surroundings. They are traditional wine taverns.
Usually on the outskirts, in the wine growing areas like Grenzing or Neusdorf.
Exactly. Places where local vintners serve their own new wine, the Heerige wine, meaning this year's.
So super fresh, young wine.
Usually white, yeah. Grüner Veltliner, Riesling, or often a blend called the Meistersatz. And the key is, legally, a Horiger can only sell its own wine.
Then how do you know if they're open?
They hang out a bundle of pine branches, the Buschen, and often a sign that says Ausgestickt. It means they're open for business, usually seasonally.
And you drink the wine, and what about food?
You usually get simple, hearty, homemade food, Hausmannskost, often served buffet style. Cold cuts, cheeses, spreads, salads, roast pork, simple, rustic, delicious.
It sounds like the perfect antidote to the imperial formality of the city center. Relaxed, cozy.
Totally. It's about Gemütlichkeit, that untranslatable German word for coziness, comfort, belonging. Sitting outdoors in the summer, under the trees, with a glass of wine and simple food. It's a core Viennese experience.
Right. We've done the emperors, the music, the coffee, the schnitzel. But Vienna has this whole other side, doesn't it? The unexpected, the slightly weird, wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. Beyond the postcard views, there's this layer of idiosyncrasy that's really fascinating. It gives the city its unique character.
So let's explore this curious corner. Where do we start? Maybe with some architecture that isn't Baroque or Ringstrasse style.
Perfect place to start is the Hundertwasser House. It's impossible to ignore.
The apartment building designed by the artist Friedensreich Hundertwasser, it looks like. Well, it doesn't look like a normal building.
Not at all. It's famous for having almost no straight lines. Hundertwasser believed straight lines were godless and immoral and belonged to rulers, not nature.
So it's all curves, uneven floors, incredibly bright colors, mosaics.
Trees growing out of windows, onion domes. The sources describe it like nature itself guided the design. It's a complete rebellion against architectural uniformity. Playful, organic, and totally unique.
Sticking with art that broke the mold. The secession building.
Right, where Klimt and his contemporaries literally seceded from the conservative art establishment.
It's that white building with the big golden globe on top.
Exactly. Locals affectionately call the dome the golden Krauthappel, the golden cabbage head, made of gilded laurel leaves.
And the motto above the door sums it up, doesn't it?
To every age, it's art. To art, it's freedom. A manifesto right there. And inside.
Klimt's Beethoven frieze, created for an exhibition back in 1902.
Yeah, a huge multi-panel interpretation of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's stunning, symbolic, dealing with suffering, desire, finding happiness through art, quintessential Klimt, and a cornerstone of Viennese modernism.
Okay, shifting tone a bit to the more macabre or contemplative side, the Zentralfriedhof.
Vienna's Central Cemetery. And it's not just a cemetery. It's like a vast park, a city in itself.
The scale is incredible. Sources say 330,000 graves.
Something like that. It's one of the largest in Europe, but it's famous for its residents.
Right, the honorary graves. Especially the musician section.
Plot 32A. You can pay respects to Beethoven, Schubert, Brahms, Johann Strauss. It's like a pilgrimage site for classical music lovers.
And the sources mentioned a cool modern edition Falco is buried there too.
Yeah. The guy who sang Rock Me Amadeus, which seems strangely fitting, blending Vienna's high classical tradition with its modern pop culture, even in death.
If we're talking burials, we have to mention the Habsburg Crypt.
The Kapuziner Gruft, or Imperial Crypt, beneath the Capuchin Church. This is where you feel the sheer weight of that dynasty.
It holds the remains of generations of emperors, empresses, archdukes.
And over 140 of them. And the sarcophagi are just unbelievable, especially the double sarcophagus of Maria Theresia and her husband, Emperor Francis III.
It's supposed to be incredibly elaborate, right? Yeah. Skulls, cherubs, symbols of power.
Peak Baroque funerary art. It's a very direct, almost overwhelming display of imperial power and mortality. Quite something to see.
Okay, maybe even darker. The Nierenturm. The Fool's Tower.
Right. This circular building was actually the first purpose-built psychiatric hospital in continental Europe, opened in 1784.
And now it's a museum.
A pathological anatomical museum. It houses this vast historical collection of medical specimens.
Preserved organs, things in jars, showing diseases and abnormalities.
Exactly. It's part of the Natural History Museum's collection now. It's definitely not for the squeamish, but it offers this really stark, unsettling look into the history of medicine and how we understood the body. A very different side of Vienna's Enlightenment era.
Let's lighten things up slightly, but still unexpected. An aquarium. In a slack tower.
Right. The Haus der Meers. Yes, this is brilliant. It's housed inside one of those massive concrete anti-aircraft towers built during World War II.
These huge, ugly, defensive structures left over from the Nazi era.
The very same. They were incredibly difficult to demolish, so some were repurposed. And this one became an aquarium and vivarium.
So you've got sharks, tropical fish, monkeys, reptiles. Mm. Living inside these thick, gray, war-era concrete walls.
Yeah, the contrast is amazing. Climbing the stairs inside, seeing the original structure, then looking into these vibrant tanks full of life. It's a powerful symbol of transformation, of life reclaiming a space built for destruction. Plus, the rooftop terrace has incredible views.
Okay, need some fun now. The Prater.
Vienna's famous amusement park. But it's more than just the rides.
Right. The big Ferris wheel, the Riesenrad, is the icon. You see it in movies like The Third Man.
Absolutely. A ride on the Riesenrad is essential, especially for the views over the city, maybe at sunset or night. But the amusement park section, the Wüstelprater, is actually surrounded by a much larger area.
The Green Prater.
The Grüner Prater. which is this huge public park meadows, forests, long avenues for walking and cycling, sports facilities. It was originally the emperor's hunting grounds, then open to the public. So it's Vienna's playground.
So you get the thrills and the relaxation side by side. Nice. What about small everyday curiosities? The Anchor Uhr clock.
Ah, the Anchor clock. On the Hallmark Square, it's this beautiful, large Art Nouveau musical clock built over an archway.
And figures parade across it.
Exactly. Every hour, on the hour, a different historical figure associated with Vienna collides across the bridge. Marcus Aurelius, Charlemagne, Maria Theresia, Haydn, 12 figures in total. At noon, they all parade together with music. It's charming, a little piece of mechanical theater in the middle of the city.
Then there's the Naschmarkt, the big market.
Oh, the Naschmarkt is an absolute must. It's Vienna's belly, a long, vibrant market stretching between subway stations.
And it's not just Austrian stuff, is it? It's very international.
Totally. You get Viennese pickles and sausages right next to stalls selling Turkish sweets, Indian spices, fresh seafood, exotic fruits, Israeli falafel. It's just an incredible sensory overload. Smells, sights, sounds, plus little restaurants and cafes. It feels like where Vienna meets the world. Great for people watching, too.
Okay, nearly there. A hidden gem, the Butterfly House.
The Schmetterling's House. Yes, it's lovely. Tucked away inside the Burggarten Park near the Hofburg.
In a beautiful old glass house, right? An Art Nouveau palm house.
That's the one. You step inside, and suddenly you're in this warm, humid, tropical environment filled with hundreds of free-flying, incredibly colored butterflies from all over the world, waterfalls, exotic plants. It's like a mini jungle escape right in the city center. Really enchanting.
Last one, maybe a bit touristy, but iconic. The Fiaker horses.
The Fiaker, yes. The traditional horse-drawn carriages you see clattering around the old town. Look, it is touristy, and it's not cheap.
No.
But seeing the Hofburg or Stephansdom from that perspective, at that slower pace, hearing the clip-clop, it does give you a certain romantic old-world feel. A unique, if slightly cliche, way to see the sights.
So yeah, Hundertwassers to Habsburg crypts, flag tower fish to butterflies. Vienna definitely keeps you guessing beyond the main sights.
And that brings us to Vienna today. Because it's not just a museum city. It's incredibly functional, highly ranked.
Yeah, that livability factor always comes up. It consistently tops those global quality of life surveys. Mercer, the economist.
And it manages this while holding onto its history. It's a city of contrasts, but they seem to make it work.
You see that visually, right? The sources mention modern architecture popping up right alongside the Baroque palaces.
Absolutely. Think of the DC Tower, designed by Dominique Perrault, the tallest building in Austria. It stands across the Danube, creating this modern counterpoint to the historic skyline. They're not afraid to mix styles as long as the quality is high.
And that blend applies to the culture, too. Old coffee houses next to trendy bars.
Exactly. The traditional coffeehouse culture, which we talked about, that slow-paced UNESCO heritage institution, exists right alongside buzzing contemporary cafes, street food markets, innovative restaurants, tech startups. It doesn't feel like one has to replace the other.
So it avoids feeling stuck in the past. It feels dynamic.
That seems to be the key to its success.
Hmm.
It integrates tradition into a very modern, functional, urban life.
So let's unpack why it ranks so high for livability. What are the practical reasons the sources give?
Well, several key things come up repeatedly. One is public transport.
The Wienerlinien, trams, buses, U-Bahn.
It's famously efficient, extensive, safe, and importantly, relatively inexpensive, especially with yearly passes for residents. It makes getting around easy without a car.
Okay, what else? Green space.
Huge factor. Vienna is surprisingly green. You have the Prater, which we mentioned, but also the Vienna Woods, Wienerwald, right on the edge of the city, numerous parks within the city, vineyards. Greenery is everywhere.
Access to nature within the city limits.
Plus, it's generally considered very safe, low crime rates. And then there's the sheer quality and accessibility of cultural offerings, museums, music, theater, often subsidized, making them available to more people.
So good infrastructure, green space, safety, culture. It sounds like good urban planning, fundamentally.
It really does. A long-term commitment to making the city work for its residents, not just showcasing its history for tourists. They seem to understand that history and daily happiness can and should coexist.
And the Danube River plays a big role in that modern livability too, doesn't it? Not just historically.
A massive role, especially with the creation of the Donauinsel Danube Island.
This long artificial island. What was the story there?
It was primarily built as part of Vienna's sophisticated flood control system in the 70s and 80s, a huge engineering project. But they cleverly designed it to also be a massive recreational area.
Smart. So it protects the city from floods and gives people somewhere to play.
Exactly. It's about 21 kilometers long, and it's packed with beaches, bars, restaurants, nightclubs, sports facilities, miles and miles of paths for cycling, skating, walking.
So it's the city's outdoor playground, essentially.
Totally. In summer, it's where Vienna goes to swim, sunbathe, relax. They hold huge free music festivals there, like the Donauinselfest. It's the complete opposite vibe to the Imperial City Center. It's all about modern leisure, nature, and fun. It perfectly complements the historical core.
Okay, so trying to pull all these threads together. Vienna, it's, well, it's
a lot. It really is. Majestic, yes. Charming, definitely. But also, as we saw, deeply quirky, sometimes dark, and always managing to surprise you.
The history isn't just in museums. You feel it in the streets. The culture isn't just performances. It's in the coffee houses, the Horrigan.
And that Lebenslust, that enjoyment of life, feels paramount. It's woven through everything, from the grand waltzes to just sitting by the Danube.
So the big takeaway, maybe for anyone listening, Vienna isn't just a city break destination. It's an experience that kind of gets under your skin.
I think so. It's a fantastic example of how a city can carry centuries of, frankly, heavy history, empire wars, ideologies, and yet transform itself into one of the most peaceful, pleasant, and functional places to live in the world today. That resilience is remarkable.
Which brings us back, I suppose, to that central puzzle we kept bumping up against, that paradox.
The Habsburg paradox.
Yeah. You have this dynasty, 650 years of the most rigid, centralized, traditional power structure imaginable, physically stamping its authority all over the city.
Creating this incredibly controlled, hierarchical environment, pomp, ceremony, conservatism.
And yet,
yeah,
in that exact same environment,
you get the explosion. Mozart, Beethoven revolutionizing music, Freud revolutionizing psychology, Klimt and Schiele revolutionizing art. Later, Wittgenstein and the Vienna Circle revolutionizing philosophy. Ideas that fundamentally challenged and ultimately outlasted the very empire they grew up in.
So the final thought we want to leave you mulling over is this. What does that incredible contradiction tell us?
Does extreme order somehow require extreme creativity as its counterpoint? Was the oppressive weight of the imperial system, perhaps, the necessary grit in the oyster that produced these pearls of genius?
Did Vienna need the rigid structure to provide something solid for its most brilliant minds to push against so forcefully? Or was it something else about the city? The coffee houses, the mix of cultures, the sheer density of talent.
How did Vienna manage to be both the bedrock of European conservatism and the cradle of European modernism all at the same time? What conditions really allow for that kind of disruptive, world-changing thinking to flourish?
Something to think about. What does it take to create an environment where genius doesn't just survive, but thrives, even under pressure? Go explore that.